Welcome to Share Talk, the only podcast where investors come first.
Hello and welcome to Share Talk and the Sunday Roast. I hope the rack of lamb is in the oven and getting ready for everyone to eat a bit later. But in the meantime, we've got Phil, Albert and Kevin, the regulars here, the old reprobates on the show. How was your week, Phil?
It's been quite a decent one again, to be honest, Zach. So I've had MHC, which has been one of our favourites, my health check, and it's 37% up since last week's pre-Easter close. So it's been a good week on that. Another one that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago was, and I think you know about this one, Zach, is Poulden's Upper Thames that has recently changed its name to VLRM, Valerium Blockchain. And I don't know if you know anything about it, but Vinay Gupta, who's a leading global figure in the blockchain sector, joined the company about 2 or 3 months ago. And he's the guy that released, he concocted Ethereum coin, basically, back in 2015. So they're running our favorite, the NFTs, the nifties, the non-fungible tokens. So they've got that element of the business, but they've also got a new element that's been added along with obviously the blockchain, which is the Bitcoin mining now in North America. The RNS came out at the beginning of the week, it was probably about 2 or 3 days ago now, and that's really helped move the share up from around the sort of 8.5 pence mark, and it hit to 12 pence today. So it's about 30% up just today alone. So that's been one it's another Aquis stock.
That's very much interesting. Interesting.
I mean, isn't the point there that they've got the NFTs, which, you know, look like that's going to be, I think there's an IPO of NFT literally next week. But the NFT is like the sort of the rock and roll, you know, like.
Yeah, and back to what, you know, Albert has his algo, he has his bot, and it pulls up the three things, you know, pulls up the certain keywords. And like that is literally like the company now. If you look at their RNSs, they've got the nifties, then the NFTs, the non-fungible tokens. They've got the blockchain element, and they've got one of the biggest like backers, you know, he's on the board as a in a non-executive role. But this is the guy that released Ethereum in 2015, which probably second to Bitcoin is the next biggest coin that everybody trades. So you've got the blockchain element, you've got the NFTs, and now, as I say, they've started working in North America with a Bitcoin miner. So, you know, if you look at the success of Argo blockchain, obviously, that, you know, you can't compare. They've been doing it for years. They've got some of the best mining equipment out there, and the rigs are amazing. But, you know, sat around the sort of, I don't know, 14, 15 million market cap, it's well under the radar. So it's one that I've been accumulating and just holding. It's been a refreshing change to log in and see something that's moving well. So that, yeah, very much a surprise this week, that one. It's Poulden's baby. You interviewed him a few weeks ago, if I remember rightly, Zach, on there. And I think Lenny Gass has got 10% of the company as well. So whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I'm sure there'll be people have their opinions of that already. But and then moving on, RMM Rambler, another one that Kevin talked about last week, is one I've held for a while. That's just starting to move now. So, you know, things are moving in the right direction. I think that's once that beast is awoken, it is going to fly, and it will do sort of 1.5-2 pence. You look at the projections for some of the, you know, the forward selling of the copper. I'm surprised it hasn't moved much quicker on the recent rise in copper prices. So definitely one that I'm going to continue to build a position in on a sub 0.4 pence. In a nutshell, that's a roundup of the week. I think there's enough there for you.
Okay. Anything from Albert?
Yeah, I've had a really good week. It's funny, actually, you just mentioned the Upper Thames holding, because I got a letter through my door 2 days ago. I opened it and it said, your shares in Upper Thames holding. And I thought, what the hell is this? Logged in. I still had shares in it. I bought loads of it years ago. What was it called? Do you remember what it was called before?
Good question.
I can't remember what it was. I bought it, turned into an absolute stinker, went right down. I think I sold it out the ISA and had it in a standard trading account. But I've got about 15, I've got a really ridiculously small amount of these shares. But all of a sudden, the account's worth £15. I've not used that account. It's my Raymond Hills account. And but it's funny that you mentioned that, because I was looking at it, and then you've just mentioned Ethereum. And Ethereum, when I used to work at Eon years ago, I got invited to do a hackathon. And the hackathon was a use case for blockchain. And what they were doing is, it's a company called Electron in London. I don't know if you've heard of them. I'm not sure if they're listed. And they were saying, what we've got to do is build a use case for it. So we came up with this idea of, we called it TE tokens. And what they were was electric tokens. You had to code all this stuff up and do a presentation in front of about 350 people. There's a lot of pressure on it. And the solution we had with these TE tokens was that you could get, TE represented what's called transportable energy. So if everyone had a charge point on their drive, what you could do with these tokens is you could go and use someone's drive to charge your car up and drive off. So, and I went for lunch with one of the coders from Ethereum, actually. And we had a few words, and because I'm a database relational guy, we were kind of having a chat about the blockchain. This was about 5 years ago. And now that solution that we put in the presentation was, it's becoming reality. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing about the whole crypto area and NFTs. I suppose they show that as well, that, you know, you can be too early to something. And a lot of these things that we have now, you know, they started 10 years ago and it's taken them maybe 5 to 10 years to get off the ground. The same with the dot-com stuff as well. That was the dot-com 2.0 has come through, you know, in the last 5 years. But it was, I think, even at the time, because you're too young to remember, probably, they were saying that, you know, a lot of these things, they're great and they're all happen, but it's just, you know, being too early
to have to wait. You've got to wait for it.
Being too late.
So, yeah, well, anyway, I made £15 on Upper Thames this week, so I'm happy about that. The MHC, I absolutely love MHC at the minute. It's one of my favourites. We're doing the calculations on it. And if you do the calculations, there's no numbers in the contract. But if you work out the 508 stores they've got, if they were to sell one kit or five kits in every one of those, even one kit, I think, worked out at a 3,000% revenue increase. Just one kit in each store a day or something. And then we did the figures on like five. That's going to be such a revenue generator because the PCR tests, what they are, so you might have seen on the news, what you've got is the free lateral throw tests, 2 a week. That's what people have. But if you look under the hood of the government document, the backbone to all of it is the PCR. So if you fail one of these lateral flow tests and come back home, you have to quarantine unless you pay for your own PCR. And you might have seen a contract today on NCYT. I think the price went down 30-odd%. 39% at one point. And that was a government contract for PCR tests, not renewed. So what it points to is you're going to get free lateral flow tests. But if you want to get out of this isolation and lockdown early, you have to take a PCR. So the PCR is becoming the backbone of the process. So the fundamentals for that stock at the moment, I mean, it was up at, I was hoping for a seven pence buy today, but I think it was 6.90 was the maximum. And it all just started with a little idea, like Kev was talking about algo keywords, the word approved, and they did get that Boots contract, and it's absolutely significant. So I've enjoyed that one this week, and we did talk about it 3 weeks ago. With what's going on with COVID at the moment, I really think a lot of people are pulling COVID stocks out, but I'm kind of doing the opposite a little bit. I've taken that, you know, you've seen this film, The Big Short. Well, I'm doing The Big Long at the minute, and I'm trying to find things I believe are in the future are going to be big. Now, COVID's here to stay, right? It's going to be here forever. So I'm looking at the early stage companies that have got some of these solutions, the companies like the SNGs, the Tizianas, the drugs that are going to be used going forwards in the future. And with the way the vaccine program's going, the AstraZeneca under 30s, the blood clots. I mean, that's quite scary because the under 30s, although, and you'll see it on Sky News a lot, the under 30s, they might not die if they get COVID, but what they're doing is they're still passing the virus around. They're giving it the mutation chance. Now, come later in the year, it feels to me as though that the vaccines, the longevity is going to wear off. The gap between the vaccines has been larger. And it feels as we come into autumn, and I don't want to say this because I want my life back. I want to get back to normal. It feels like if cases start going up, there's going to be a panic. We've had the vaccine, it's coming back. So I've built more of a position this week. I've done my first trade in 2 weeks. I've taken a little bit more of the scan cell, and I can elaborate on that one later. So I've been buying and trying to predict the future, basically. And it's been a great week. My portfolio is up about 40% in 3 weeks. So I'm happy. I'm a happy chappy.
Good man. I mean, one of the things this week, though, is that, I mean, it had to be a positive week because we've had so many bad weeks. I mean, for normal traders, not for people like you.
And tax year ISA is getting loaded.
Yes, exactly. So that's what I was going to say. I mean, it really, you know, if it hadn't been a positive week this week, I think we were sort of almost like thrown in the towel because it had been 4 or 5 weeks of a quite painful, you know, grind and erosion of the small cap area. And I mean, I don't know who wants to answer this, but isn't it the case that the market did respond? We broke 6,800 on the FTSE, which was a resistance from since the start of the year. So the ISA money did come in, and it's probably still looking for a home.
Yeah, it's a stock picker's market, as they say at the minute, isn't it?
Ed's just joy. He's been listening in the background for a few minutes. Just welcome, Ed, and you know, appreciate your time.
Thanks very much. Apologies, I'm late. I'll give you the actual reason. I was having what's known as a DEXA scan. Very interesting. Looks at your sort of body composition and bone, body mass index, fat, visceral fat, all that stuff. Really interesting.
Okay. Nothing invasive?
Nothing at all invasive, but really interesting.
No rubber gloves?
No rubber gloves.
This to do with the Juvence or whatever you call them, Ed?
Nothing to do with Juvenescence, just a sort of readily available tool that lots of people can go and use just to sort of give themselves a look at where they're at in terms of their health.
Okay, so yeah, the same as the other two guys, I had loaded up on MHC and continued to add this week. So that's been a real plus. Not sure where I got all the money from. Oh, yes, I am. Sorry. I got all the money because I sold all of my SYME. I'm out. I decided after listening to the interview with AZ that it's going to be June or September. So I decided, halas, I'm not staying in this for now. Yes, I will revisit it. I'll be back, I hope.
You might want to revisit when they get the cracking RNS, Kev.
Ah, yes, Kraken's coming, for sure.
The old Kraken RNS.
The minute he cracks the nut and then puts the Kraken RNS in, we'll be back in like a rabbit up a drainpipe.
It's going to 10 bag on Monday, isn't it?
Now you've sold it. Yeah, well,
10 bag on the way, Kraken RNS, here it comes.
Good luck to everybody, but it won't be good luck to me. Anyway, my overall portfolio, I managed to claw back quite a bit of what SYME did damage to me last time. I was 6.7% up this week, so I was pretty pleased with that. MHC was good. RMM, Rambler, yeah, it's just started to tick up. It's gone from 0.32 to 0.38 it touched today. The churn is obviously over, and any buying now is just making the price go up. So I think we're going to just see a steady rise. Yeah, we might get boom, but I actually hope we get a steady rise. So yeah, it was actually quite liberating selling SYME. Not now. It was quite liberating selling SYME because we've been sort of dreaming the dream since last August or even before when we bought it at 0.005. And up, down, up, down, up, down, since it went up and then came back down 0.33. So this for me was good. But yeah, overtraded again as usual, but halas, this is me.
And isn't that one of the things that when you're in a stock and you're finding yourself hoping, it's not normally a good, it's you're either wasting time or something bad's going to happen quite soon as well. So you've got the two things there.
If
I look at the 100,000 plus that I had invested in SYME over the last, 6 or 7 months, if I'd had it somewhere else, I think I could have doubled it at least. And yet I've lost quite a lot of it. So Albert said something to me last time about off air about No, try and make your positions more equal. If they grow, then great, they can be bigger, which is what my position is in Zoetech, because it's grown, it's much bigger than the other ones.
It's containers on the Titanic. That's what it is, containers on the Titanic. Yeah. That's how I see stock, spread it out. One barrel burst, you're still going to keep floating.
Yeah, so I sort of listened a bit to that and decided this week, yes, in my overtrading way, that I would spread it a bit more. So I did that. You know, I reduced a few positions and increased a few positions, and hopefully I'll continue to do that over the next few weeks just to try and even things up. But if it's on growth, I'll have to accept it. It's good. If it's on cash put in, then yeah. So we have to grow courage as the shares grow. You know, if I get 10 bags on a share, then, and I still think there's a lot more to go, then I have to grow courage to keep it. Yes, maybe there should be some slicing, but still I have to go with my gut and think, no, there's a lot more left in this. So that's it. So that's me this week.
All right, so guest of honor this week.
Just one more comment. Sorry, apologize. Right. I added 400,000 fast forward. There you go, Ed. Oh, now it's your turn.
Very good. How do you feel about that, Ed? Is that okay?
Is that okay? Yeah, I'm very pleased about that. I mean, I think it's always good to hear that people are looking at the company that you run and are sort of seeing the virtues of it, even if it's not anything to do with my virtues and it's just to do with the company itself and the assets, which is the first thing that people should look at. Is the company good? And then you start looking at the management. I always think it's a weird way around to do things the other way. But yeah, no, it's great. It's always fantastic to hear when people are buying shares in a company that you're heavily involved in.
Did you hear the roast last week, Ed, or not? Sorry.
I did, yeah. It was someone kindly sent it to me, and yeah, it was obviously. I'm not sure whether I'm allowed to agree or disagree or have to stay neutral, but you know, it was very interesting to hear, and I liked definitely things that were said.
But we've done it long enough now that people discuss something, and you hear their sort of logic and their idea and their belief. And it's been interesting that a lot of the stocks, I mean, MHC, for instance, when that was talked about, I thought, my God, what are they talking about? There's no hope. I mean, it's in an area which is like, you know, the testing area. It's, you know, so old news, et cetera, et cetera. But if everything stacks up, which it did, and because, you know, the guys don't normally let it not stack up, if you see what I mean, it, you know, it works. And it just, you know, that was great. Even Tiziana, I think Albert mentioned it as well. That was up 10, 15%. In the couple of days after he mentioned it. So it is something that there is value there, just talking things through, but not, you know, not dictating. Other people can cut in and say, look, that's crap, or that bit's a bit flimsy, or that bit's good.
That's very interesting, Zach. You raise a really good point there. And it's something that I see. I'm not a religious watcher of the message boards and things that are said about companies that I'm involved in. But, you know, naturally it filters through, whether it's somebody sending it to you or on a Sunday night, you sit there and you kind of gauge the temperature of sentiment towards your any given stock that you're involved in. And I see this all the time. I see these investors who are ramming it down other people's throats, and it's just not helpful. People need to be able to have sensible places. These forums should be a discussion. They should be a debate. It shouldn't be you're wrong and I'm right, because the reality is no one knows whether they're wrong or right until you either sell or decide to hold your position. Ultimately, it's what you buy a stock and it's what you sell a stock for that matters. So you can't always be right. And you might be fundamentally right about a company in saying this company is rubbish or you know, this company's great, but the rubbish company may still go on and 10X and the sensible, well-managed company goes down 50%. It's not an exact science, this business, and what is right doesn't always happen.
So, I mean, I'm just looking at the, with Ed, I'm just looking at the investments that you've had recently, Cannabones Cellular Goods, which are obviously one of the couple of the hot IPOs of the year. Is that the strategy of the company to go for sort of pre-IPO or the new stuff, let's say?
No, look, it's not. It's not a core strategy of ours. I think if there are interesting opportunities, certainly in both those cases, we always viewed them as fairly quick turnarounds. And in both cases, they turned out to be fairly rapid turnarounds. We didn't expect to be holding those companies in the long run. Now, that is not because we don't think that they're good management, they're good ideas, but we felt that they were massively overvalued. Some people, we got grief for selling it from some people, and we also got grief for not announcing that we'd sold it sooner. But, you know, and this is the reality of it. We kind of have a pretty good idea of what happens in the market. We know when we start to see companies, even if we've gone very early into the book for an allocation, we know whether they're going to kind of go, whether they're going to be a bit saucy, so to speak. My job is not to get overly emotional about these things. And actually, if something's on the table today and it's overtraded and it's crazy valuation, we've got to sell it. But so if there's a good opportunity, and some things we may invest in and hold for much longer periods. But generally, it's a balance, as I see it, of having effectively companies at early stage. For example, let's say we had 10 assets. I'd like to have 2 to 3 that are fairly early stage where we're going to be able to really look to try and generate venture capital type returns. Then there's going to be that sort of middle ground where the company may be a bit more established. We really know the management very well. We know what they're capable of. We know what they've done before. Those are the things that we're going to be looking to bring into that kind of pre-IPO, IPO liquidity event. And then, of course, things that have already come through that whole process, but we still want to carry on holding. So it's really, for us, it's about having a blended portfolio where in some cases we're really looking at to go for that kind of knockout VC return. In some cases it's more of the sort of PE turn, i.e. sort of sub 2, 3, 4x. But you know, one thing we haven't been truly brilliant at, and it's something that I'm looking to alter, and I think we've got a couple of positions that will help us change that. I really want to get some proper VC returns, some real sort of, you know, 10x pluses.
So you're the company that you're working for, fast forward, it's kind of what we're doing with stocks on a larger scale. Is that I've not done any research on it, so I could ask a couple of questions. Yeah. I thought it'd be, so what does the company actually do?
We're actually a regulated fund. So we're a closed-end investor, yeah, based out of, yeah, Guernsey, regulated by the Guernsey Financial Services Commission. And obviously we're listed on AIM. So
yeah,
we're not an operational company in so much as we actually own and operate the assets. We're simply a fund.
So you're doing similar things to us then. You're trying to predict the future in a way of these, the growth of these companies. What are they into the microchips or the green energy of the future? That, have you got a desired like sector, or you just said you wanted a variety, but is there anything in particular that's like drawing your attention, the future of? I know there's the crypto stuff going on at the minute. There's a company called Solly. I'm not invested in that company, but they're doing stuff with electric trains and all of this stuff. And for me, I'm trying to think what I've got the shorter, the longer, generally medium and longer positions, but I'm trying to kind of predict what will be really big in the future and take some of those as longer term investments. So it sounds like you're doing that with a bigger fund. So you're not, you go on the board of any of these, or?
Yeah, there's a few key differences between what we do versus, you know, private investors.
Yeah.
Ultimately, we're obviously running a fund that is effectively for shareholders. So, you know, it's shareholders' money. You know, in many cases, some of the directors are obviously invested. And
yeah,
when I'm allowed, I hope to be well invested as well. But essentially, what we do differently is, obviously, we have experience, and this is not to say that you guys don't, but we have experience in operating companies in the sector that we focus on. The sector that we focus on, we've sort of telegraphed it to the market many times now, is the cannabis sector. We do still have legacy assets that are not in cannabis, but ultimately, we've very much, it's what Fastball has been guilty of in the past. It's been a bit too broad. It's been a bit too, yeah, sort of flexible. And what we've really decided to do is narrow that focus down to the area where we believe that we have the most influence, we're going to get the best bang for our buck, and we can actually ultimately not just be an investor to these companies, but we can help with them in terms of helping distribute, yeah, products, in terms of,
yeah,
helping get them M&A targets, in helping
get them off the ground, help them get going.
Not just getting companies off the ground, but getting established companies where we feel that, yeah, we can bring something, a vertical maybe that they, right, don't really have, that we can help with. And we've demonstrated, yeah, that
Well, so you're kind of like Bobby Axelrod off that Sky programme then. Is it called Billions? You're like Bobby Axelrod off Billions. Well, you will be when you can invest in stuff.
Yeah, we hope that we can become, we hope that we can be a bit less illegal than Bobby Axelrod. But we hope to certainly be able to grow our funds.
Ed, when you start the investment and when you start doing due diligence on these companies, say what do you, you know, from an investor's point of view, what do you look for and look for, obviously, you know, signals that are, you know, buy signals and return on investment and things, you know, you chat with presumably the board of directors of said company, you know, Yuma or whoever it is. But what is it that you're looking for? You're looking for a story. You're looking for a dynamic board. You're looking for other directors, you know, that have had skin in the, you know, that have got a good CV. What, you know, can you talk us through what drives you to make those investments?
Do you know what, Phil? This is the thing. There are a few key things that we look at every time, but things come around in a very different way. So interesting, you mentioned Yuma, which actually is a very different story because it was an asset that we already held in the company. So yeah. It was a legacy asset before I got involved. But what we then did, we realized that they had an incredible business platform, but they weren't utilizing it in the right sector. So what we actually did is help them pivot the business, utilizing our investment understanding in that sector, i.e. in the cannabinoid wellness sector.
Yeah.
And we effectively completely revolutionized that business and gave it a much better purpose, which we could actually see ourselves making a great deal more money out of versus the sort of space that it was previously operating in. But the one key thing was we took a platform that was working very well. It just wasn't able to be monetized as well as it should have been because it was effectively in the wrong industry. But going back to your question, it's rare that I see a company that I've never heard of at all before, especially in the cannabis sector. Normally we will have an idea of who the people are. But then, because obviously we're dealing with a highly regulated sector, my first thing that I will do is look into their licenses, look into their assets, look into their business model. Then, once I'm comfortable that what they have is real, that it is what it says on the tin, that they haven't misunderstood their own license, which is often what happens, to be honest, we will sort of rigorously check all of these things. Thankfully, I've got a lot of very good connections in the space. So it's not always just me. I'll have other people that I know and trust who will have a look at these things. And often it will be a case of me talking to somebody at a ministry. For example, if it's an asset that's got a German presence, I will talk to the people that I know at the German health ministry to find out that these guys are legit, effectively. So I'll go all the way down that trail. Normally, as I said, it's people that we often know them a little bit already. So it's a case of, you know, I look this guy or girl in the eyes, do they really have what it takes? Are they, when times get tough, which they inevitably always do with any business, are these guys going to fall on their sword or are they going to find a solution? Because there's this, you know, there is this sort of, I see it sometimes amongst some investors, and again, it's not to be offensive, but I see this thing that these people sometimes think that these things are linear. You know, it's just one big long path to glory. It's not. You can have a company that ultimately becomes a $1 billion company, but I tell you, that company would have been at the precipice, on the edge, a number of different times. Very, very rarely you get a company that just goes on this lovely linear growth journey. There are hard times.
Definitely.
And I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand. You know, as director, you're never going to go, oh, you know, God, it's really awful. You know, on Sunday night, we were thinking, should we can this thing? On Monday morning, we'd all regrouped and actually we were back on the right track. But it is difficult. Building companies is difficult.
It goes back to what we said last week as well about, I mean, one of my fundamentals is the board of directors. And if you look at previous track records, what have they done? Have they ran a unicorn? Have they sold a unicorn? You know, this type of thing. Yeah. What did they do? Where did the company come from? Have they turned nothing into something? And that's, we were talking about this last week. So you were saying, looking in the eye, can they do this? And you can look at the track record, but you do get the new ones where you've got someone that's absolutely blockbuster that's never done anything before with a great idea. They're going to IPO something or do something and it's going to sail off into the distance. But it's hard there. I suppose they must be the toughest ones to try and find, but the ones that are going to give you the biggest returns.
I don't always agree with that. I see a lot of, I meet a lot of very, very impressive people. I've been really fortunate And I meet people who've, you know, had two or three serious wins in a row. And of course, you do go, well, I want to back this person. But what I'm really interested in is finding that person, that guy or girl, who's actually hasn't had that win yet.
It's a good angle. I like it.
Where
it's
I can help them create that value. Because look, these people, they're not always, they aren't the complete package, right? At the end of the day, I'm really interested. Every time I meet a company, I'm like, who's your finance guy? I want to sit in a room with that person for 2 or 3 hours and make sure that they know what they're doing, because it's all going to work. You could be the best CEO in the world, but chances are you're not the best.
Have you got any jobs going, Ed? I like the sound of this, mate.
Yeah, look.
Ed, let me ask you a question. I mean, you basically created EMAC yourself from the ground up with a few others. Is that right?
I was a founder of the company. I don't ever want to be sitting here saying, hey, I did all this. You know, it was a massive with an incredibly wide skill set. And again, this is one thing that you learn when you build a company from nothing, from an idea. You know, how are you going to get to that place that you want to be? And the reality is, it's very rarely it's, hey, it's all about this one guy, right? Actually, we were so lucky in terms of, we had the sort of people around us to help us build that. Yeah. And I mean, you know, for example, our CFO, he is without a doubt the best CFO that I've ever seen or worked with. And I mean, incredible. Like, just the work ethic alone was something to behold, but the attention to detail and the sort of the balance of risk versus reward and the way that all of those, you know, all of the different companies, because it was a big group by the end of it, we had lots of different companies, the way that all of those things were managed, it was sort of superhuman. You know, Antonio, our CEO, you know, a brilliant statesman, like a politician, very brilliant listener, always had a solution, was brilliant at summarizing the discussions we had. Our COO, fantastic at effectively just drilling through things, making sure that everything was exactly where it was meant to be. To a lesser degree, myself, with finding very specific assets. I knew what we needed, and it was about effectively retrofitting, well, retrofitting, not the right word, but finding a platform that we that really knew what it was doing, particularly in the medical sector, so had that medical understanding, and then we could actually overlay our talents and expertise in cannabis and help those businesses grow very, very quickly in what was really an extension of what they already knew. But those people already had some, again, some of the best acquisitions and just seamless, beautiful company cultures. There wasn't that sort of awkward phase where you bought a company and then they were like, oh, we're not really interested anymore. Everyone was pulling in the same direction. So it's rare that that happens, but it's something that's created. You have to start with the right ingredients. And I think that's the same for most companies.
Yeah. So the deal that you factored, which was to take quite a few of the assets and dump them in Yuma and then sell EMAC. Now, we couldn't hold the shares, so we ended up with £5 million in Fast Forward. But it seems that was quite a good deal and you didn't really get the credit for that because we don't necessarily want to be in the biggest cannabis company in the world. We want to be in the startups. So I don't actually think the market quite got it. Yes, we would have all liked 20 million for EMAC, but I think what happened was actually a good deal. But do you want to explain a bit more?
Thanks, Kevin. I think you're one of the first people to be pleasant about that. A lot of people have been, I must say, some of the sort of vitriolic, horrific posts and messages I've had about it were just awful. And I understand some people had a view that EMAC was going to be worth $1 billion or it was going to be worth this. And in due course, I totally don't disagree with them. But the reality is, unfortunately, from a Fast Forward perspective, we were a minority shareholder in terms of we had 2%, just over 2%. We tried extremely hard and we actually delayed EMAC in the first place, really getting on with its funding because we desperately tried to get Fast Forward in at the founder level, but unfortunately the exchange just our regulator just wasn't having it, and there was nothing we could do about it. And you know, at the time, I of course was a non-executive of Fast Forward, so the whole point was I wanted to build this business, and my co-founders also wanted to do the same. So we did our best on that front, but ultimately, Do I believe if EMAC had floated that it would have got to a potentially higher valuation than where it did? Quite possibly is the answer. The reality is, from a fast forward perspective, we would have been locked in for at least 12 months, potentially more. So we couldn't do anything about that from a liquidity point of view. If Fast Forward was able to hold Curaleaf shares, it would have effectively been on the same terms as me, which is largely that you're locked in on pretty much 85% of your sale for the best part of the next three or more years. So actually, Fast Forward has done extremely well out of it in terms of getting a cash settlement on day one, because I know a lot of shareholders who would have loved to get a full cash settlement on day one. Granted, we miss out on the potential earnout, which is approximately 16.6%, but that is not a guarantee by any stretch. And over the next 3 or 4 years, if we can't make 16.6% on that money, I'd be very, very upset. So it's one of those things. Part of me would have obviously, as a founder, would have loved to see the company IPO, but ultimately for the shareholders, 97.8% of shareholders in EMAC. This is a great transaction. And actually for Fast Forward, it's also a great transaction because, look, we're now in a position where there are cash shells out there that are trading at much higher valuations than we are. And quite honestly, we're asset backed and we have cash, significantly more cash than many of those cash shells out there. And guess what? We've got the know-how of how to make it happen in this sector. So yeah. Buzzing with excitement. I mean, really buzzing because...
But the point I was making also, the thing that really got me about the EMAC after my initial, oh no, why did we sell it for so little? Was the fact that the week before we had offloaded stuff into Yuma from EMAC.
Yes.
So this to me was the master plan. Yuma, I presume, is going to be Yuma USA, Yuma Europe, Yuma Far East. You know, it's a big picture there, I think.
Yeah, Yuma's got global ambitions, undoubtedly. Obviously, it's one of the first, it's probably the first CBD and hemp lifestyle company in Asia. They're very, very well tuned into China, Japan, and Taiwan, and also a little further afield into Australia as well. They've obviously bought the Sakati assets in the USA, so they've got a very nice footprint there in the USA. And of course, they've got European-based brands, which they bought from EMAC. So I think you can see the story unfolding there. I think it's very likely that we'll see those guys float here in London as well, have a secondary listing here in London, sorry. It made total sense that Yuma became a vehicle that was dealing solely with the CBD cannabinoid wellness piece, and that EMAC continued its journey really as a pharmaceutical cannabis business, which is what it really is. I think you're absolutely right. I think Yuma is going to be a really, really interesting one over the next sort of 12 months. Again, it's a company that we've got liquid assets on, but we've got no intention of selling any shares in Yuma right now because we think there's a hell of a lot of upside in it. And, you know, again, you can take comfort in the fact that the people who are behind that business and who are running that business on a daily basis really know the sector. They've been around in the North American cannabis industry since its inception. So they really know their way around. They really understand Europe because of the sort of crossover with what we've done with EMAC and previously what had been done with Nuvera. You know, again, it's one of these things. You guys were talking about it earlier. Who do you back? Well, number one, it's always good to back people who know the industry that they're in. Number two, have they got capital or have they got access to capital? Yes. And are the assets good? Yes. I mean, that's a pretty good basis for any investment, in my opinion. You know, the Holy Trinity, I like to call it. Assets, management, and cash. Have you got all three of those things? Yes. Well, you know, I feel much more comfortable than going in with someone who's got a great asset, but they're pretty average management and they haven't got any cash. Like that, it's just a fairly obvious logical steps towards making a call on risk.
Yeah.
So Johnny on the spot question now, Ed, you have to answer it. Have you enjoyed speaking to Endeavor?
There's some things that I can and can't say. I can talk about IMG and the guys at the IMG and IMG Arena. Freddie, who sits on the board of Leap with me and is obviously very, very involved with IMG. You know, those guys are great. I mean, they really know their space. If I were being totally honest, I would say that they don't aggressively roll these things out. They do take their time and they're very deliberate and very steady with what they do. for a sort of more entrepreneurial, like I want things done yesterday type guy, which is me, you know, I find that quite frustrating, but they know their game and good on them. I think they're a good asset to Leap. And ultimately, I think we've just to sort of manage expectations to some degree, we are still fully 100% focused on a float for Leap Gaming. I think my personal view is that it'll go fantastically here in London. I just can't see how a company with the stock mechanics that Leap has, the management, the investors and the household names and the product, it just screams, this is a very investable business. So I think it would go fantastically well.
So Ed, can I ask you a question? So how are you doing this with COVID? You know, you like to sit in the room and look someone in the eye or get in there with the finance. Are you doing this on Zoom or, you know, with the COVID at the minute? I mean, I've worked from home I work, you know, remotely doing programming and coding. And I've not really, I used to work it down in the city at Moorgate. I used to go down there and it's nice to get that. To judge someone properly, it's nice to be in the same room and get the vibe and the energy and all of this. How are you doing this? Are you doing this over like conference calls or Zooms, or how are you coping with this during COVID?
It does make it more tricky. You're absolutely right. And it's a brilliant question because I really like to sit in the room with somebody, sit opposite them. And it sounds awful, but I quite like seeing people sort of squirm in their chair a bit if they're a bit nervous, or talk too much if they can't handle a bit of silence and things like that. And I know I'm very verbose. I talk a lot. So, but believe it or not,
you and Albert will get along then. This could be a 4-hour call at this rate.
Hey, hold on, Phil. But Phil rang me up last night. We had a chat about midnight. And when I got off the phone, it was 4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Never talked to Phil after midnight. It's like feeding the gremlins.
Especially after a few jars as well.
Yeah.
Well, do you know what, guys? That's a great thing, though. You know what? I love it. You know, it's somewhat different when it's sort of people that you have a personal relationship with as well. But, you know, when you're in a sort of pure business setting, even if you know them quite well, there's this sort of, we all have a bit of a switch, or we should be able to switch into that kind of, right, this is business now. Here's the hard fact. And look, I really like people to sort of, you know, I don't mind people showing what their sort of weakness is and things like that. And actually, I really like it when people turn around and say, well, look, you know, I'm damn good at this, but these areas I'm weak.
I love that question. I remember once I got asked that in an interview, and I was talking to a lovely lady last night about the same thing. And that question, what's your weakness? The way I always do it, I'll have 5 examples in an interview, and it's kind of how to turn the negative positive. So my example was, well, what's your weakness? And then what you can do is, if you've got a story or an idea. So what I did in that example, I was working at E.ON back in the day, and I devised a system. And the system was, you'd have like a load of tickets in the morning, and say 10 tickets or something, but you'd have to look at all of them and there might only be one failure. So I'd got this system where it would send me an email in like HTML, and all of the ones that needed looking at were green. So I'd have to look at one ticket a day. But the problem was, I didn't tell anyone about it. So I went on holiday, and what happened is, the work stream got inundated that were covering me with tickets. And the management were like, well, what's this? Where are all these tickets come from? So then there's an example of a process that I've written that makes the thing faster. And then the delivery to that question was, I've done something good, but my weakness was I haven't got the communication skills. I don't share my knowledge with the team. And if you answer, swing on a positive. So if you go into an interview, for me, what I have is I'll have 5 strong examples that you can relate to any behavior. If you know what I mean. And well, that's how I
So I think you do.
If I'd get an investment, I think.
you spoke too much and you didn't listen.
Yeah. Well, no, because I actually, that example was real. And the manager at E.ON, I was going for a higher job. When I gave the answer, he sat me down and he said, I've never given anyone a 5 in an interview before. He said, but that question, that answer blew me away. So it worked. But sometimes they like to say, squirm in your chair, don't they? They go, oh, what's your weakness? I'm too perfect. You know, you get the cocky one or you just get the freeze. So it's a good question, but spin a positive at it.
Yeah, no one has all the answers. That's the reality of any situation. And you know,
yeah.
But what you want to be able to do in any situation, and particularly in business, and, you know, forget about personal life for a second, but in business, you need to be able to look around the room and go, well, like, shit, I haven't got the answer to this one. You know, who does? And you want
And
ideally, you want more than one person to be going, right, I've got an idea. And then they're going to work. They're going to maybe state their sort of somewhat well thought out idea, because they've been listening to the conversation. They haven't sort of been talking away. They've been listening and forming a view and actually finding a solution to it that really may work, because they've actually done fairly quick math in their head. Then they go and sort of work the idea through more, and maybe it comes back to you slightly nuanced from what was previously discussed, but you know, that's how things happen. And similarly, I'm well aware of what my flaws are. I like to communicate. I have a very good sense for people. So what I studied at uni, for example, I've always been very interested in psychology. I've always been very interested in law. And you know, understanding what drives people is also really important, because let's be honest, if you say to somebody, right, I really want you to come work for me, but I don't really want to pay you very much for it. Well, immediately you're basically saying to that person, I want you to do me a favor. I'm going to use your skills. I'm going to use your talents, but I'm not going to give you what you're worth for it. Now, that's a really shocking place to start. And the reality is, in life, if you want good people, you know, you get what you pay for. Now, you might get people to take a bit of a leap of faith early doors, and that happens due to financial constraints, especially in public companies. But if you can't get people to leave from the off, and you can't say to them, look, we're going to look after you properly, we're going to treat you well, then you're not going to get people that really give everything for you. And one thing I've always been pretty good at in the businesses that I've got is I've had staff that have stayed with the company for a very, very, very long time. And again, Emac's a great example. I don't think we had anybody who left voluntarily. I don't think we had anybody, right? And that, over a period of 3 years, when you're working in a really intense environment that is all day, every day, weekends.
I think that is key as well. I mean, you just gave feedback on your CFO and COO, and that appreciation for me, it goes a long way. People like to feel worthy or appreciated. You know what I mean? It's that gratitude. It's what drives people. And if you get it, are you going to get that where, you know, you might get paid more money to go and work somewhere else, but you're going to get that gratitude, and you're going to get that feeling of success. You know what I mean? And that keeps people with, you know, it keeps like a tighter circle.
Yeah.
Well, look, so it was nice to hear you say that about, you know, the two members.
Everybody wants to be loved.
Yeah, look, exactly. Everything in life is a trade as well, right? I'm trading your time for money. I'm trading your knowledge for money. Whatever it might be, there's a trade, right? And you have to get that trade right. And you also have to know when you've... Equally, you have to know when you've done a bad trade and you cut it, right? If you're talking about stocks, that's what this is all about, ultimately. How many times have you sat there and run a position that you knew in your gut was a really, you know, it was a hiding to nothing, but you sort of, you were listening to other people and they were saying, oh, this thing's going to be great. And you're, you know, they weren't really giving you a brilliant rationale as to why, but you sort of, you almost had a bit of fear of missing out. Now, I've done that. I don't really do that anymore, because now if I really think something's toast, I'm not worried about, oh, well, it might go up in the future. I'm going, look, I don't want this on my mind.
On that point, you have £6.5 million burning a hole in Fast Forward's pocket. Give us an idea. I'm not talking about companies, but give us an idea of your philosophy, if you like, over the next few months of how you're going to invest that money.
So there's a number of different things. There's obviously some support of existing portfolio assets. So one thing I do believe is important, if I'm going to invest in something today, I want it to be something I still want to invest in tomorrow. People always talk about averaging down. Well, look, I'd rather average up personally. All right, you might see that as sort of diminishing returns, but I disagree with that. If I believe in something today and it performs, then there's no reason I shouldn't invest and support that company going forward, because ultimately they've come to me and said, we're going to do this. They go and do it. All right. It's not always perfect, but let's say largely they do everything they said that they were going to do. They do it in the time frame and in the budget that they said they were going to do it. All right. The company's grown. We now need more capital, to grow, to keep that pace going. Absolutely. I'm going to be there, because ultimately subject to capital. So that's my rationale about supporting certain assets within the portfolio.
So is there anything you wish that you'd bought more of then as an investment? Have you put a position and thought, oh God, I mean, I do that quite a lot. When EUA was below a penny, 0.36. I have to put the approval slip in where I work, and I got it. It was just a $5,000 that I was putting in. Got the approval. I never did the trade. And if I did that trade, I'd have doubled it up and I'd have made, I mean, I did fantastically out of the UA, but is there anything that you've invested in that's done really well that you wish your position was bigger in?
Oh yeah, many times. But again, there's, you know, one has to be real about these things. And ultimately, I always had this vision for my own life where I was going to build a very, on one hand, I was going to build a very stable, very solid business that was based around land, because I always think that owning land is never particularly a bad thing. If you own land and you can create a yield out of it, then it's a very safe, defensible asset. And that's what I've done on one part of my professional life, if you like. On the other side, I wanted to have what was really very high risk, because look, everything we're talking about here is all very high risk stuff. A step too far to the left and you fail, you can sell too early, you can sell too late, all of these things. So there's a huge amount of risk. But I always wanted to have that sort of blue sky possibility of going into things that were new, risky, and required you to put your balls on the line. Maybe I'm not a true entrepreneur because I always wanted to also have that stability. But in my mind, it's still an entrepreneurial pursuit to go and build land-based assets that grow and continue to grow. But yeah, so there's lots of things I wish I'd bought more of. But again, there's also been times where I've just not been able to. I haven't had the cash, and you have to make a decision. Like, am I going to spread my arbitrary number? Am I going to spend my 100,000 across five different things, or am I going to put it all in one?
And you can get the big one. When I mean, I'm in the similar positions at the minute, doing similar things to that, and it's a tricky one. And sometimes my portfolio is invested in everything I love, but there's new things that I'm seeing, and I want them. And you have to get to that position where you think, which one do I like more?
And that's
which
that's
one, right. You know.
But I think it's easy because you get great. I mean, if you're doing that and you're reflecting on it and thinking, I wish I'd have put more in, you're obviously, you've done well on that initially. But you know, anyone who looks back and thinks, I wish I'd have bought more, they're doing
the greed. It's the greed thing.
You're doing something.
Let the greed go.
Never look back on a good investment that you've, you know, two, three.
I think it's when you've got and you're ready to buy it. You're ready to strike. And I was ready to strike ARB. And it's too binary. I still say it's too binary. I can't buy things I don't know. It goes up and down. You know, it's like the wind blowing or the rain coming down. Is it going to rain today? Is it going to be windy?
Yeah.
There's no fun. But I do wish that I put, I think it was about 10 grand I was going in. It wasn't massive, but 10 grand in the ARB. And it was like 7 to 14p. And I look at that now and I think, I wish I did it, but it's fundamentally not right for me. It's a punt. It's a spread, you know. It's like putting, you're going to score 3 goals against Manchester United. It's one of those for me. And I don't like to play the market as a gamble. I like to play it as a science, you know.
It's really easy to look back on things. Like we can all look back on things and think, God, I wish I'd bought more of them. Or, you know, I bought this business. God, there were 3 other businesses similar to that. I should have bought them as well. You know, it's very easy to look back. At the time, the reason you didn't do it was because there was a good reason. And that's what you've just got to accept.
Yeah.
You know,
You talked about Eurasia Energy. Like I was pretty close to that, funny enough, and I never bought any, right? I just didn't believe in it. To be frank, I still don't believe in it. But ultimately, again, a lot of people made a lot of money. Some people who were really close to me made life-changing money.
I sold 60 times. I got a 60 times return. And then with the 60 times return, I did a 20 times on the entire fund. So I was happy with that. And then I think if I just left it in that position, it might be, you know, 70. I think it's 100 times what I bought it for right now. It's similar. But then, you know, you could have done a lot more with just doing. And I like to find new things. It gets boring just being, you know, the same thing all the time.
It's incredible. Look, I wish I'd been able to put more money into EMAC when we started it. I wish I'd been able to follow more money in the following rounds. I wish Fast Forward had been able to put more money in, you know, all of these things. But, you know, and would I do it again? Yeah, I would, you know.
The 3 times I've done it, I've got the slip, I've got approval to purchase, because I work in financial services. I need the approvals, you see, because I work very close to, you know, like market makers and things. So everything I do is it's all approval. And I did it the other day and I got a slip in.
I think it's,
and I was thinking, can you do it? And I did it this time. So this time I've added more. And it was profits from elsewhere. So I'm hoping this one pays off. I think it will.
Yeah, but
it was an average.
Okay, so Ed, bring us back to the subject. Ed, what about investments that are going to happen in the next few days, weeks, whatever? Have you got anything on your radar?
I've got a number of different things on the radar. You'll see, I think, quite a lot of activity over the next couple of months. Now, one thing I've always said, I think when I say, look, we've got deals ready to go, it may be that I'm ready to go and it may be that we've done our due diligence, but we still have to, we're a regulated company.
For goodness sake, don't put any time, don't put any self-imposed time deadlines or timelines in like crazy does.
Yeah, it's very important to say that. We obviously have we're in a highly regulated market. Despite what I hear people say about AIM the whole time, AIM is seriously highly regulated. I don't, you know, people say it's like this cesspit of, yeah, there's bad things can happen, but that's the same on every market. But actually, AIM, you have a nominated advisor. They're always terrified of losing their license. So they're very, very
I've got a question about that, Ed, just quickly. You mentioned a Nomad. How much of an influence, I've always wondered this, how much of an influence do they have on in terms of the board in making, could they walk into a boardroom meeting and say, we want to have a say in the way you're doing these things? Or do they not have a say on some of these executive decisions?
Look, they definitely have an impact on it, because ultimately I can say, right, Nomad, I want to do this deal. And they can turn around and say, well, AIM doesn't agree.
Yeah.
And the point is, I don't have a direct line with AIM. It's, I talk to AIM through them.
Okay. So that's more of a
regulatory AIM. They are AIM.
Agreed.
Nomad is AIM.
Yeah. So that's a regulatory hurdle, that there's something regarding the deal that it doesn't meet the regulation or the MAR or what, you know, equivalent of. What I meant was, if they don't like something you're doing, like they don't like the company you're investing in, can they turn around and say, no, I think you're making the wrong decision on that, Ed. We shouldn't be investing in that company. They've got, you know, previous for doing, you know, there's someone on the board we don't like, you know, do they have that amount of say on it?
So AIM is it's a really tricky market in many respects, because effectively, and I'm not, this is not in any way, just to be very clear, I'm not having a go at Nomads. They are doing a very important service. But there's two different things to consider here. There's the Nomad themselves doing the right thing for, sorry, there's three different things actually. So there's the Nomad doing the right thing for shareholders, i.e. to protect shareholders. Yeah. There's the Nomad doing the right thing to protect themselves and their reputation and their license. And then there's AIM, who get to effectively act in the spirit of the rules, not, you know, if you look at the AIM rule book, it's very, very thin. Yes. You look at the LSE rule book, it's very, very thick. Now, there's a reason for that, and that's because AIM are very, very concerned about their reputation. And I understand why, because there's been a lot of frauds, there's been a lot of bad behavior over the years. It's actually quite a clean place to be now, quite honestly. So look, you've got those three different things.
Yeah,
us, the company, our agenda is to do what we think is the absolute right thing for our shareholders, right? Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. What is the best deal that is going to enrich our shareholders the most, right? Believe it or not, I know a lot of shareholders out there think that there's some weird conspiracy that we're trying to screw them, which is just mind-bogglingly stupid. But ultimately, everyone's coming at it from a slightly different angle. You're putting your Nomad to make decisions that effectively should be the right thing for the shareholders. So there are situations, quite frankly, where company and Nomad will effectively have some fairly harsh words with each other, and we will actively...
Do you ever think about going on the official list then, or something in your pipeline, or
the official list? And again, seriously, guys, I could talk to you for hours about this one subject. In fact, depacking the cannabis industry, for example, would take us days, let alone hours. But talk about the LSE versus AIM. On the LSE, you're effectively self-signing off as a board on what you put out. So I'll give you an example. Recently, there was a company that made an announcement and it used all these like terms like game changing, huge milestone and all this. That announcement that they put out, as an AIM company, we wouldn't have even been able to put an RNS reach out, right? It was a non-starter. It was a non-deal. But for this company, the fact that they were on the LSE allowed them to put it out as this like monstrously incredible statement. And it was incredibly misleading. We could never have got even close to that. We probably would have been able to put out an RNS reach if we were lucky, right? And it would have been very toned down. It would have been like, this has happened and this means X, Y, and Z. And I might have been able to put a statement in there that said, oh, this is good. But they even would have tried to temper my statement if it was too...
I've noticed that as well. There's been a lot of announcements recently that companies that have literally just almost put an RNS out for the sake of putting an RNS and really hammed it up. And you just think, really, did you know that's an abuse of your powers effectively. And I'm not going to name any names, but you see it quite frequently. I mean, I read every RNS in the morning, literally read every RNS through ShareFad. And some of them, I just think you can't put news, you know, it's not even worthy of a press release, let alone an RNS reach, but they're putting it out as it's an abuse of the RNS system.
Phil, I get in trouble. I get grief from shareholders for not putting out the fact that somebody ate a sandwich out as an RNS. So, you know, there is a fine balance. I understand that companies, their fiduciary duty to their shareholders is to promote the company. So I get it. But ultimately, there are very, very big differences between the LSE and AIM. And I'm not saying the LSE standard is a bad exchange. I've got companies that I'm involved in that are listed on that exchange. And I think it's a great exchange from a cannabis perspective. It's really the only exchange you can go on as an operator. Remember, Fast Forward is the only AIM company that's got any direct exposure to medical cannabis, unless somebody's done something in the last few days that I'm not aware of. Yeah. And the reason we've done that is because, like, number one, we're financially fairly savvy. Number two, we're highly regulated, and we've been very early in this space and demonstrated that we know what we're doing. And going back to Kevin's point on what are we going to do with the war chest that we have right now? Well, look, we've got a number of different things that are in late stage due diligence. We've got some things that are pretty much ready to go. And obviously I can't go into any real detail on that, but my job is to effectively utilize the knowledge of myself, my board, and the people that advise us to ultimately get the best possible result for shareholders. Now, how do I do that? Well, in this market, you've got a very, very hot sort of cannabis sector by virtue of the fact that there's very few options for people to buy into if they want exposure to either cannabinoid wellness or medical cannabis. Mm. Now, what do we have on the market right now? We've got a few companies, they're not good, they're not bad, they're just, you know, valuations are sort of questionable in some cases. And, you know, again, I'll probably get abused for saying that because everyone wants to believe that everything's worth a billion. I got a lot of abuse for Fast Forward, for EMAC only selling for effectively £290 million. You know, oh, it was rubbish valuation. It should be more than that. Well, if these people know better than me, they should set up their own fund and do it. That's the honest truth.
There's way too many companies out there in the CBD space that are way overvalued. You know, like some of the list, look at the listing of CBX and things like that, and MGC or MXC. You know, you look at it and think the revenues are, you know, as a fundamentalist, you look at the PE ratios and multipliers in the CBD space, and then look at the revenues and see, I don't know, 100,000 revenues for last year. And you just think, how have they got a valuation of 100 million? And there's no, and then your company, you know, your Fast FFWD, you know, market cap of around the 20 million mark closed today. Yep. 21 mil, 9.95 close, price to NAV of 1.1, cash position of what, probably six and a half million quid. There's just a massive disparity in the value of your company compared to some of these so-called new CBD plays. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, you know? And that's fine. And we accept that. I think I said on a podcast the other day that actually if we were just a cash shell with no assets and the cash that we've got, we'd probably be a higher market cap than we are right now. Now, that's just the way that certain groups like to sort of get involved with these companies and trade them up, and they support them. And it's sort of like a bit of a syndicate effect, and that's fine. Like, you know, that's just the market. In the long run, businesses that keep delivering, like Fast Forward, I have to add, it has delivered. It's delivered real cash returns on real businesses that have sold over the last sort of 3-4 years. It's done it more than once, and we're going to continue doing that. So you can either put value on people that deliver cash returns, or you can go in purely on the blue sky piece. By the way, we've got quite a lot of blue sky as well. It's up to you, and I can't tell people what they should do with their money. It's really up to them. But ultimately, all you can do as a business nowadays is go, look, you're right in so much as revenues versus market cap, there will be a big disparity in quite a lot of the cannabinoid focused businesses. And one of the reasons for that is obviously growth in that sector can be extremely fast. What I would say, and I've said it many times before, is the CBD space is a very, very tricky space because it is ultimately about how good are you at fast-moving consumer good brands. Now, yep. If you're not good at them and you couldn't sell protein shakes and you couldn't sell tea bags and you couldn't sell milkshakes or whatever, you're probably not going to be that great just because it's CBD.
It's massively down, the CBD industry is massively down to how good you're marketing, how good you do two things, your marketing and your distribution. If you can get those two things right on as little as budget as possible and be as frugal as possible, then the company will do well.
Or on the other hand, you have a hell of a big war chest and you're able to do it with a huge budget.
Yeah.
Brew dog of the industry, which yes. Comes out of nowhere and suddenly becomes this massive player because their PR and marketing game was so damn good.
Yeah.
And also it was just perfect timing and they created a cult following and it just worked for them.
Yeah.
That's not going to be the same for everyone. They're one in a thousand. They're one in 10,000. They're one in a million, right?
Agreed.
Now, what do I want? I want the guys that knew how to build Voss water or Gatorade or something like that, because guess what? Those guys, all right, they spent a hell of a lot of money getting there, but they've got serious market share. They know what they're doing. Yeah. They've built the whole thing. And actually, that's what consumer brands are all about, right? Cannabis on the other front, which is medical cannabis and pharma, that to me is where there's a huge amount more value at this point in time. And the reason is because it's so much more highly regulated. There are much fewer licenses. The ability to actually sell a product that is effectively in a race to the bottom in terms of the price and actually still make margin. If you can do that, I mean, it's very hard for people to sort of go and raise hundreds and hundreds of millions just to step into that market. So what you'll find is good medical cannabis businesses are going to have much, much bigger reasons for being valued significantly higher than their revenues. And that's what I think people should be aware of. But again, and sorry, I know you want to say something, but it is really important that we also accept that not all companies are created equally. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what, like looking at, you know, all of a sudden they just suddenly re-rate and, you know, it comes out of nowhere. And I'm sure that it will happen. I look at some of the investments for FFWD and I think, wow, you know, it's just amazing. You know, the Portage and Northern Leaf and things, you know, there are some amazing investments. So it's, and looking at the cash, as I said, the cash position and the price to NAV, it just seems so massively undervalued. So I'm sure it will happen, and I wish you well with it.
We've been really lucky before. I mean, in terms of, we sold Nuvera back in 2018, I believe it was, and we made a really poor decision off the back of that. We invested in a sector that we didn't really know, we didn't really understand, and key to that, we didn't really know the people that well. We could see that the writing was on the wall, and actually, in that particular space, we should have been looking to sell our asset there, not invest more. And I'm talking about Factum here.
Yeah.
Whereas had we stuck to our game plan, had we stuck with the cannabis theme, we would be, you know, it would have been a totally different story. But the reality is this time round, we won't be making that mistake because we know exactly what path we need to stay on. We know exactly what we're doing, in so much as a company can know exactly what they're doing. And again, the nature of any early stage, any VC type investing is you are going to have things that will go wrong along the way. And we've shown that with Factum, and we've shown that with a couple of very small assets, but not everything is going to be a home run. But for me, it's all about, can I keep hitting, to use a cricket analogy, and by the way, I don't even particularly like cricket, but you've got to keep hitting singles all the time, right? You've got to stay at the crease. You've got to keep hitting singles. You hit the odd four and you hit the odd six, but if you can't just keep hitting singles, you aren't going to be there to get the fours and sixes, right?
You got to keep the scoreboard turning over.
Correct. And that is my number one game. And when I talk about fours and sixes, I'm talking about more of the kind of VC return stuff. The singles are the kind of, you know, if you get 2 and 3x, and I was, Lorne, funny enough, who was former CEO of Fast Forward, told me this the other day, and he was damn right. He said, Ed, if someone invests in your company and within a year you've made them twice their money, and they call you up and give you grief about it, delete their number. Pardon my French. And he was absolutely right.
that's true, mate. I mean, I've given tips to people and they've like double, triple bagged. And what you find is, what I find is nobody ever says thank you when it's going up. The odd person does. I've had like the odd bottles of champagne, the old Paul Roger landing on my doorstep. But you know, when it goes down, they're over you like a rash.
You know
what I mean? You're not Mystic Meg. You know, you're going to get bad ones, you're going to get good ones. But yeah, I know what you're saying there.
you know, take responsibility. If someone said to me, and look, I've got lots of mates who call me up all the time, I have to be very careful. I don't really trade a huge amount of stocks. I tend to either hold things very short term or I hold them very long term, not in between that normally. And the reason is because I don't like to, obviously, I've got to be very careful. We have a regulated fund. I don't want to ever get in a situation where it's something that we might buy as a fund or that we might look at as a fund. I just got to be very careful. So I tend not to sort of like trade around the edges or anything like that. I'm very focused on what I do. It is very important that, and again, with people, I don't sort of call my mates up and go, hey guys, you should invest in my company. If anything, by not doing that, they're more, they often call me and ask me about it. I say, look, I don't really want to, you know, have this conversation. I'd much rather you just go and research it. Here's some links to the website and stuff like that. Because you know what? I want them to form their own decisions. And I also obviously explain to them, and luckily most of my friends are very financially savvy, so they know that they can't ask me anything that's too close. But it's amazing the people, some of the people that we've hired along the way with EMAC, for example, two of them came up to me like, oh my God, I didn't realize you were involved in this company. Yeah, I bought shares because I saw it in the Evening Standard a couple of years back. And, you know, I'd never met these people from Adam. And it's a great feeling, but at the same time, it does create a bit of pressure. I don't mind it. I'm quite thick skinned. But, you know, where it comes to people that you've done well for, you know, they have to just be respectful in that. And again, I get a lot of messages from private investors who all want to know something that they shouldn't know. And it's really, I find that incredibly disrespectful, because it's basically them saying, look, I don't give a rat's ass about your career. I just care about making whatever quantum of cash it is for myself. And I think that's just not on. And I don't respond to those sort of things, obviously, but...
Yeah, I mean, I've had the same, Ed. I've been inside on a few companies. I've crossed the line, as they say, I've gone over the wall, and I've had people ring me and say, can you give us some inside information? And you're just thinking, you're an idiot. You know, you don't understand the implications of what that means for me, because I could effectively spend time inside if I say anything.
Not just you, but them as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it's conspiracy, effectively. You know, you're going to both go down for it, and you can't, you know, it's just ridiculous to even...
It's not about... I believe in the markets. I believe the market ultimately is right. It's not always right, but ultimately at some point in the future, it will become right, because it will give you a fair value if you do the right thing. Yeah. If it doesn't, well, you've got to change something up, and we're always looking to evolve, and we're always looking to change how we do things in order to make sure that the market does eventually give us the credit that we deserve, whether that be in terms of share price or whether that just be in terms of the sentiment. But we're all going to have this roller coaster ride at one point or another, right? There's no such thing, from what I can see, as a linear share price, unless you step way, way, way back and look at it from a distance over a long period of time. And, you know, going back.
But if you look at fast forward, Ed, effectively, fast forward was trading at a positive to the NAV until, I think, 2018, when Factum went bang, like it was above the NAV. And then since then, it's pretty much been trading below it ever since.
Correct.
So there is a belief mismatch here, I think, because ultimately, as you've said, the 6.5 million in a shell now would probably be worth close to 20 million, maybe more.
Correct.
And we also have, what, £13 million worth of assets on stock markets. So it's like, how do you work this one out? You know, it doesn't make any sense at all.
And private assets are privately held, you know, just
yes,
audited value.
But assets in general. Yeah, I mean, basically, the NAV now is probably about 11 or 12p, no?
There's two different versions of NAV, right? There's historical NAV that we have had audited. And of course, that will always be dragging behind where the actual real NAV is. So versus you only have to, it'll take you 2 minutes to do the maths on it. But if you look at our previously audited NAV, you'll see that things like Leap, for example, are valued at, you know, a bit over £7 million.
Yes.
This is not a leading statement, but it's up to you. Do you believe that our 43% in Leap is only worth £7 million now? I can't give you the answer to that, but you can do.
No, well, I can give you the answer. I think it's worth 30 or 40 million.
Okay. But I can't give you that answer. But what I can say is when you look at some of the things that we have as liquid assets, you can tell that our Yuma stock was at 85 cents and it's now a dollar. I can't remember what it is today, but it's about $1.40-ish. that's a significant increase on the NAV as stated. So, you know, it takes a lot to do the maths, and it's just important to remember that private assets, they only get revalued if there's a fundraise, and also every fundraise isn't the same. For example, if I'm following my money in something, I'm obviously not necessarily, I'm going to want to get the best deal for my shareholders. So I'm not necessarily going to pay what the true value of that business is. And the business that we're investing in is going to go, well, you're a very large shareholder, so we sort of have to stomach to some degree what you want the valuation to be. It doesn't mean that we sell it for. There's always a disconnect between these things. And again, we can't make the minds up of our shareholders. We can't get them to press the buy or sell button, although a lot of investors seem to think that we somehow are the market makers as well and control the share price on a daily basis. I realize, you know, I'd be very, very foolish to think that we don't have a big influence on the share price. But one thing is always quite tricky as well. Investment companies on AIM, unlike in the US and other territories, they haven't always had the best time of it. And it's kind of dumb in some respects, because as you very correctly said, you have this sort of underpinned value, which is audited quite rigorously. And then you've got the additional layer of regulation on it by the fact that we're actually a regulated fund. We have to be pretty sensible when we put out numbers. We can't put out numbers where we really would love them to be or where we even think they would be. We have to put them out at a very conservative view more often than not.
Even the other assets that you've got, like the asset for the lending, student lending in the US, BMO. I think this is not a billion pound company, but it's billions and billions of pounds industry, and it's valued very little.
Can I rewind, fast forward a bit?
You can.
Can I rewind? Where did the name come from? Sorry, it's all gone a bit technical. I'm just ground it a little bit. So where did the name Fast Forward come from? Did you have anything to do with that, Ed? Or
I had nothing to do with Fast Forward. It is a legacy name, and it is entirely about it to do with a book that Jim Mellon wrote. Jim was our former chairman. He's still a large shareholder of Fast Forward. Yeah. And I have a good relationship with Jim. He's got some very interesting things going on.
So would you ever consider changing it? I like it. It makes me feel like the stock's going to fly.
Absolutely.
Fast forward.
Look, for me personally...
Sorry, I had to get that little cliche rewind in there.
No, it was very good. It was very skillful. I think... I'd be lying if I said that I love the name Fast Forward. I myself and... I can't speak for all the board. They would agree that, you know, we'd like to put our own label on it to some degree, because ultimately we're the ones running it now and sort of controlling the along with our shareholders and their desires, we're pushing that in the direction that we believe is best. And, you know, I definitely think a name change at some point to really own that. It's a natural progression. I can't say for certain whether that happens sooner or later, but definitely been on my mind for a long time.
You know, we've got a 20 million market cap now. What's your end game here? Is it 200 million? Is it 2 billion? Are you going to be the next Rothschild? What's your vision of success, or what's your goal for this company?
There's a really great question, Zach. And I think, you and I have come across each other many times over the years, and we've had some good chats at various events and things like that. You know, as you correctly said, I've been out of the sort of corporate finance game for a while now. I loved it, by the way, but it was just, I had this entrepreneurial thing that I had to go and do. And when we look at the cannabis sector, I'd been to North America. I'd seen the vision of the future and what was going to happen. So I'm not original in that respect, but I saw what was going to happen. And I thought, Jesus, you know, it's not just a culture thing. I mean, there's so many different things to it, but this is real. And I think it's going to be the biggest opportunity in our lifetimes, quite frankly. But anyway, that's another thing. Your question, where do I think, you know, what's the end game on this? Well, there isn't really an end game, I think, Zach. There's just goals as I see it. And number one, my first goal is for Fast Forward to surpass 50 million of market cap, 50 million of NAV as well. Ideally, I think NAV rightfully should follow market cap rather than the other way around, because I think the nature of what we do versus a sort of managed fund or a property REIT or something like that is very different. You can understand why that sort of large property thing, you pay a discount to NAV on those things. But what we're doing, we're dealing with very, very fast growing businesses. I think it's sensible that these things trade ahead of NAV. If you could go back and buy like property as a sort of ETF 20 years ago or 30 years ago or more, you'd have what actually looked, if you looked at it over that period of time, a fairly linear line upwards, right? And I think that's what's going to happen for something like Fast Forward as time moves on, because we're in a sector that is going to be one of the biggest themes of the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, but certainly the next 10 years are going to be enormous. So for me, I don't think there is a limit on what we can achieve. I don't sort of sit there and think, oh, you know, I want to be a $1 billion fund, or I want to be a this, or I want to be a that. I just think if we just keep progressing and the message finally gets home to shareholders that we kind of know a little bit about what we're doing. We don't have all the answers, but we got a lot of answers. We've shown that we can not only invest in things, but can actively get involved in operating them and get really good results, globally significant results in the sectors that we're dealing in. Maybe, just maybe, it's worth not just trading in and out of it, but actually going, you know what? A bit like if you really believe in a sector, I'm going to put some money in it. I'm going to treat it like an asset, because that's what it should be. 50 million, 100 million, those are my sort of short-term goals. Beyond that, it will obviously depend a lot on regulation. My goal is to do this in as non-dilutionary fashion as possible. I want it to be organic growth from the assets that really gets us to these sort of numbers. There will, of course, in due course, and I mean in due course, because there's no reason why we could possibly need cash anytime soon, there will come a point. If we become a £100 million company, would I want to go and raise 20 million or something? Yeah, probably. If the time was right and there were opportunities out there, that's what any sensible company would do. And people shouldn't be scared of that either. That's growth. That would then allow us to accelerate to 200 million. So ultimately, there is no limit on what we can achieve. I think it's really just a question of everyone sort of pulling in the right direction as well. Trusting the fact that we, you know, again, I always see it on a daily, weekly basis, these private investors who just always think it's this, them and us. It's not. We're working for you guys, whether you think we are or not. We are. We have to. That's our job. We're regulated. We have no choice. And we wouldn't. And, you know, if we didn't want to do it, we wouldn't bother. You know, we go and do something else, because I don't make loads of money out of Fast Forward. I really don't. Like, there are other things I could do and make a lot more money. I do it because I believe in it. And I think it's not about where we are now. It's where we're going to be in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, and just that journey and ultimately that delivery. And the more I deliver for people, the better my career becomes, the better my reputation becomes. And that matters to me more than money, right? Money is like a side effect of success, if you ask me, right? It's not what I get out of bed in the morning. I don't think, oh, I've got to make another £1 million. Like, that's not what gets me excited. The journey, getting there, the support, the sentiment, all those things, that's what drives me.
I love what you just said there, Ed, because you know what? For me, I mean, I've got some nice big positions and things, but it isn't the money that drives me. It's the idea. It's kind of beating the system. That's the thing that I like to do. And we're going back to the gratitude, and it's that positive feeling of winning that drives me as a person. You know what I mean? So, you know, you buy a stock that's a piece of shit. No one even knows what it is. Well, I remember when I had the MHC, and I don't mean to talk about that one again, but it was nothing. No tweets on Twitter. Absolutely
yes,
nothing.
Yes, you do.
You know what I mean? Well, you know what I mean? And it isn't the money that gets me. You know what gets me? It's the feeling of succeeding in an idea. It's a little dream coming true. And that's
okay.
That's
send me all your money and I will praise you.
No, but forget. I mean, what does money do? What do you do with money? You go on holiday, you eat a nice dinner, but you don't get the feeling from spending that money as you do from picking an idea that's going to explode. And that's the driver for me.
It's a really good point, Albert.
Anyway, Ed, I would like to be invited to the £1 party, okay?
Absolutely. And I promise you, when we get there, we will make sure that we have a big party. Because look, I also think that's a really good point you raised. It's really important for us all at some point to celebrate success. You know, when we do have success, we want to try. Obviously, we're in a COVID era at the moment, so it's pretty damn hard to do that. But, you know, people should be sort of getting together and discussing their wins and their losses, but particularly their wins, and saying, hey, guys, didn't we do well on that? You know, not not just passing it off as, oh, that was great. You've got to cement yourself in those kind of moments to some degree. And I'm sorry if I'm sounding a bit hippie here, but really cementing yourself in that moment of when you've had success drives you for the next success, because you're really living in that moment and you're really, you become expectant, right? And that way, you know, there's a lot to be said for walking into a room confidently and going, I'm going to change your life.
Yeah, you know? Agreed. Sorry, what's everyone's view on the market then? Is it bull, bear, bubble? I'm feeling extremely bull at the moment, and I'm heading into that. I mean, the CDB, the cannabis, it's great. Yeah, I think it's going to explode and rocket off into the distance over the coming years. But I'm feeling that the markets for me are like bio bull. I'm like a massive bio bull at the minute. I'm probably 90% in bio stocks at the moment. What's everyone's views? I know there's a lot of speculation on like the bubble and bursting and the bear market coming back, but I seriously think that this year is going to be a bull, especially towards the end of the year. And then I think when the Brexit comes, that's already happened, but I mean when the recession comes, that's when we'll start, you know, when all of this is done and COVID settling down, I feel that the bear market will creep up on us and just like a big black cloud and just crush us down. But I don't think that's going to come for a while. I think this year is going to be bull. You've got people pulling back and thinking, oh, I'm not going to go near the COVID, I'm not going to go this. But I really feel like it's that market sentiment we were talking about last week. And because people are vaccinated just in this country, you've got this, you know, I'm not going to go near the coast, but I just feel that it's going to come back. And I think this is going to be a bull run year. And then next year, I think when the debt starts creeping up on us and the GDP and so on, I think we're going to end up just the big rain clouds going to come. So I'm personally taking massive advantage on this year. That's I'd like to hear other people's opinions on it, because the majority of opinions are thinking bubble pull positions have cash, but I'm doing the opposite.
I think you're spot on that, but I think that it's a much tougher market. You've got to be good at picking the stocks now. You know what I mean? Like there are some winners out there, but like you look at the movers on a daily basis now, and I sort by all shares, like all 2000 items. And that, you know, 6 months ago, a year ago, there was stuff that was like, you know, 2x-ing on a daily basis. There was 7 or 8 stocks a day that were bagging, right, and doing more. Now they're moving, some of them are doing 80, 90%, one or two. And, you know, you look at the top movers, there's probably 15 or 16 in that sort of that have done 10%. So, you know, back to your point, I think, yes, there's going to be a bull market and it will continue for months. Personally, I'm not. I am still in some farmers, but select farmers like NSCI and MHC, stuff that I think will make a PDSB, stuff that will really make a big difference, that are kind of the best of the COVID stocks that have got something unique that they're offering, like PCR testing, as you say, or boots, and also, you know, something, the different strains, something, you know, a vaccination that is, you know, it's resistant to every single strain of you know, the N and the S or whatever it is, a different strain. So stocks like that we've talked about previously are fantastic. But I'm also massively into the CBD space, but not so much the medical, which probably won't resonate much with Ed. I'm a wellness guy now. I think that I'm sold on it. I take CBD, different companies, and I love it. And I think that during lockdown, with anxiety and stress going through the roof, it outsold vitamin C last year in the UK. And the global market for CBD for the wellness sector is going to be something like $20 billion by 2024. So you've just got to build your position in the right companies now. And you're in at ground level valuations, and that for me is to get the right company with the right distribution agreements, the right sponsorship deals, and you're gonna nail it. And for me, that's my focus now, is building in many different CBD companies that I believe in, basically.
That's a good. It's a really interesting thing to hear, Phil. I think you're not wrong at all about health and wellness being a major priority for the vast majority of human beings, regardless of which country you live in. Obviously disposable income in Europe is somewhat better than many other parts of the world. So that's a very, and population size and age is a very important thing. So like, I totally agree with you, but the complexity is on the ability of these people who any, you know, I get a CBD company or two every single day. I get a deck. And do you know how many I would invest in? Pretty much none of them. And there's a reason for that. It's because I've lived it. I've breathed it. I know what happens and I know how damn hard it is. And just because you've got an account at Holland & Barrett doesn't mean that you're, you know, you're a winner, right? You might be a cottage industry type guy. To be a real global powerhouse in that and to actually be able to have a business when Virgin comes in or Estee Lauder or one of these big players who's got a massive, massive brand already and the ability to spend huge amounts of money on this, once they say, right, we're coming into this, they're going to absolutely crush some of these small guys. Now, there'll be winners. There really will be. But I tell you, it's going to be people who know how to build FMCG brands and they understand the space. On the medical side, I think you've got to think of it slightly differently. You've got to look at North America. You've got to look at Canada and particularly the USA. You go to Colorado, right? And you can walk into any off-license in Colorado and get served immediately. Good luck doing that in one of the cannabis dispensaries out there. I'm telling you, these things are absolutely crushing it. They've sold more cannabis in Colorado last year than alcohol, right? And guess what? It's market segments like women over 60 that are like some of your biggest growing customers base. The stigma is changing, regulation is changing, but if you're a CBD company, you're going to find it very difficult to become a regulated cannabis business if it starts going recreational or adult use or anything sort of quasi that space in Europe. You're going to, it's the medical operators, the people who've been trusted by governments, healthcare professionals who've done research, who are science-led, they're the ones that will get the licenses, not the CBD players. So I agree with what you're saying, but actually the really big prize is not doing 4 million of CBD revenue. It's doing 400 million of cannabis revenue. So that's, yeah, that's my view on that. And again, just going back to my general view on the market, well, I think there are a few key things. Obviously, you've got governments printing money left, right and center right now. So there's liquidity around. There's a massive disconnect between the stock markets and the high street. Right? That is going to be a problem at some point. We all have to accept that that's going to happen. Yep. What will happen is you'll see less of a bull state across all different industries, and you'll see very specific industry, very specific segments picking up. One of them, as you correctly said, is going to be health and wellness, but there'll be a lot of losers in that as well. Number two, I think cannabis is, as I said, like there's nothing that anybody can say, because I've seen it, I've been there, I've lived it, that says that it is not going to be a massive thing. For the next 10 years, we're still at like baby stages, right? We've got serious growth to come. 10 years time, you'll start to see some real sort of well-known brands and it'll be very much more brand oriented. But right now it's still who can build the best business the quickest, right? And that is, you know, you look at all these big brands.
And again, back to marketing as well, like Charlotte's Web in the US are spending $30-40 million a year on marketing, and they're probably just about getting the same amount of revenue back for spend. So that's not a good way. That's not, you know,
it's nothing, by the way. That's nothing in terms of marketing spend. That's tiny. That's like, you know, so these big brands, they spend $500 million a year on marketing, right? So it's nothing. Like Charlotte's Web is a great bit. I know the guys, I know the Stanley brothers, you know, a couple of them really well. Great guys. They were the first narrative in the space, and that's what created their brand. But I tell you, they're up against it against some real big guys. They'll still be successful, don't get me wrong, but it's, you know, it's a real hard job for them. Yeah. The other thing that people need to look at as well is just like not necessarily just plant-based food, but I mean clean meats and stuff. And I know I'm not a cheerleader for Jim on this, but he's damn right. Anthony Chow as well, who's a friend of mine and a very, very smart guy, who's behind Agronomics, for example, those kind of companies, you'll see hard markets for everyone and shares will move around a bit. They'll move up and down. But ultimately, if they move down, I'd just be buying more of them. Like those are the kind of things that over the next decade are going to make people so much money, right? Over the next 2 and 3 years, they're going to make people so much money. Over the next decade, it's like gangbuster stuff. So it's a question of there's something for every time horizon, but I do think it's going to get very specific. And things like clean meat, cannabis, biotech and all that stuff will continue to do well, but you're just going to have to do your research. And again, you have to do your research on everything. But early adopters who've been well capitalized, who have very good management skills, who know the sector, who can help companies with more than just capital who are equally people who are just operators, but have got a very good track record of doing so. There'll be ups and downs. Of course there will. The cannabis sector, there'll be tumbleweed for periods of time. But I promise you, if you look back in 10 years' time, you will see what is effectively a linear graph that goes from zero to a hell of a lot. Yeah. You know, that's the reality of it. And I'm just super excited. People have said, obviously, I did well out of MAC. There's no two ways about it. I'm really pleased about that. And quite frankly, I think I should have. I took the risk. I left my job to do it. But I think on a personal level, and again, I'm not that money isn't the thing that really drives me on a daily basis, but I think I'm going to make way more money out of the next 10 years than I've made out of the last 3 years. Put it that way.
Yeah.
Ed, you came across extremely well. I think it was very, very good.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I think that, like, obviously I've listened to it for 2 hours. We've all been here and I've enjoyed every minute, to be honest. And I'm hope that, Ed, you know, that you've enjoyed it, you know.
As I said, I really love this form of discussion. I think long form discussion is something that's coming back. I think, you know, that's why I must say podcasts have revolutionized my life in terms of the ability. I used to sit there and drive a lot. I'm in my car a lot because I've got land-based businesses, so I'm often out just checking on them, making sure everyone's doing what they're meant to be doing, which means I spend a lot of time in the car. I used to listen to music or just be on the phone. I listen to so many podcasts now, and it's revolutionized my sort of what used to be dead time, because now I'm learning stuff that I never would have known about because Joe Rogan's got someone on, or our ability to learn stuff on the go while we're doing stuff that used to be dead time is phenomenal. And I think for investors, it's like one of the best things that's ever happened to them. Now, of course, you have very, very different levels of investors. You have guys that want to follow people. You know, they just want to follow five guys on Twitter and they'll make all their investment decisions for them. And then you've got those people who are more like those five guys without the sort of trying to be an influencer, who actually want to go and learn and really research. And like you said earlier, Albert, they want to go and find something that no one else is looking at. And that, by the way, is absolutely the job of the fund manager, really. It's no point in jumping on the bandwagon and what everyone else is doing. The best thing you can ever find is a stock that you go, I've looked at this from every angle, I'm buying it. Thank God no one else is looking at it because I can load up while it's cheap. Perfect. Money is a byproduct. It's a side effect of doing something well. And if you can continue to do it well, then probably you're quite good at it. If you're, every dog's going to have his day. Every dog's going to get lucky now and again, but it's, can you recreate the same thing multiple times?
Yeah. I really want to say my next week for a reason.
Okay. All right.
Because of what the guys did today, I want to say it. So if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so my share for the week ahead is actually going to be Love Hemp. Why, I hear you ask? Well, I think the RNS they got this week was transformational. They raised the money that they obviously desperately needed. But more importantly, they're going to move on off the Aquis exchange and onto the main market or AIM, I'm not sure which. And the white labeling of the UFC deal, I think, is transformational for this company. Purely on volume, they're going to be producers. They're going to be producing large amounts of CBD, high-quality stuff that's going to be going in this deal. So I expect that it's going to be fairly tightly held, currently around 4p. If you look at the numbers, I think it's 7 or 8 times the revenue. Current revenue's about annualized 6.2 million. So you're looking at around 50 million as a valuation if you look at 7 and 8 times. So that would put us comfortably in the 7 or 8p range after this raise at 3.5p. And even fully valued with all the warrants, it's only worth about 32 million at the minute, so still plenty of room to move up. And I think with the UFC deal coming by the end of the year, I'm really hoping for 12 to 15p, and it really should do that. So, and I'd also just like to thank all the guys that supported me today in terms of raising some money for some projects that we have. And I'm now a lifer.
Good on you.
But I will tell you that my main share is still Zoetech. Make sure you buy some of those chill fags because they're going to work and we're going to make lots and lots of money.
Yeah, that's Goodbye. Zoetech for people who don't understand what Kevin's saying. Zoetech.
Not zoetic. Zoetic.
Yeah, zoetic. In a parallel universe, there's a company called Zoetic, which is already in the FTSE 100.
The one he's talking about.
Talking about is actually Zoetic and 180 million market cap or something like that, I think, at the moment.
And I would just like to say, as a comment, thank you, Ed. You're a brilliant guest. You're welcome anytime.
Thanks, Kevin.
I will reiterate the same thing. It's been brilliant. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Phil.
Yeah, thank you, Ed. I mean, I must have missed you for the last 4 or 5 years. It's amazing, really.
It's been around that last 3 years. I've been, head down, EMAC, and fast forward.
Thank you, guys. And see at least some of you next Sunday.
Cheers.
Indeed.
Thank you for listening. Remember to visit our website for more news and other podcasts at www.share-talk.com.